Okay, I think we're going to start. So first of all, since it's the last of the four shiurim, so I just want to thank Rachel Miller for her technical help, and Rabbi Jay Kelman, of course, who is in Greece right now, I believe. And we are going to start. Okay, so the last shiur will discuss traditional commentary and academic contributions. I hope everyone's okay with this. We're probably going to get to the academic half, the second part of this year, because I want to make a point in terms of the traditional commentary in the first part, which is as follows. We discussed in the past, I believe the first year, that a lot of traditional famous commentaries put more of their energies into the legal sections, into the halachic parts. We noted that this was true of Tosfot, and many of the Spanish Rishonim medieval commentaries, the same thing is true. I would just like to point out, I've noticed an interesting pattern that when you get to authorities of the last couple hundred years, and again, I'm generalizing, of course, there are exceptions, I believe that they are more prone to comment on both the halakha and the Agadah. So even though earlier in this series, we talked about some of the classic commentaries in Agadah, we mentioned that one might want to go to the Maharsha and the Maharal. I also would like to point out that that is not the only place to look. And we shouldn't come to the conclusion that, oh, when it comes to the Agadah, there's nothing there. It's just myself and the text, which again, you could have tackled the text your own. Of course, that's legitimate. But to realize that we can get help from some of the great minds in our tradition, particularly of the last couple of 100 years. So I'd like to show you a few examples of this. That'll be the first part of this year. And then we'll move to the academic contribution in the second part of this year. Okay, so let's go to a little share screen here. And we'll see what's happening. Okay, here we go. Great. Okay, so let us take a look. Right away, we'll see already the first source. Okay, there's a lot of Gemara today, so we have everything, almost everything in English. It makes life very easy. Okay, so we mentioned once that the last Perek of Sanhedrin is the one that's all Agadah. It is not legal at all. It is called Perek HaChilek. So there's an interesting dialogue there that the Gemara says happened with God and Yeravam. Yeravam is, of course, the, as it were, renegade king who split the Jewish monarchy, right? Early on, after David and Shlomo, right, we have Yeravam splitting off Malchut Yisrael from Malchut Yehuda. He breaks off from Rechavam. So he is definitely considered a problematic king. And there's a pasuk that says, okay, I'm reading now the first source. After this thing, Yeravam turned not from his evil way. So there's some kind of davar. Something happened that could have, in theory, made Yeravam turn his life around, get his act together. But it didn't happen. Now, what was this thing? So Rabbi Abba said, after the Holy One, blessed be he, had seized Yeravam by his garment and urged him, repent then, do tshuva, Yeravam. I, thou, and the son of Yishai, namely David, will walk in Gan Eden, in the Garden of Eden. Now, that is a pretty good deal. You have God saying, I will, if you just do tshuva, you're going to be together, right? It'll be me, a pretty good threesome, me, you, and David HaMelech there in Gan Eden. Okay, now you see the Gemara is just so sharp, so powerful. What question does Yeravam have? Sounds like a great deal. So Yeravam says, wait, and who shall be at the head? Mi Barosh. I mean, who will have more prominence in that little gathering? Inquired he, and God answers, the son of Jesse shall be the head, meaning Ben Yishai will be first. I mean, you'll have a very good place, pretty honorable location. But what can you do? You'll have second billing to David HaMelech. If so, he replied, I do not desire it. Now, again, even if we don't have any fancy commentary, I think the Gemara certainly speaks for itself, right? The desire for honor, the arrogance of a human being, that you could turn down such a deal just because you're going to be like in second place. You're not going to be more prominent than David HaMelech. Okay, great. But maybe something else is going on. And here's, again, our first example where traditional commentary is helpful. Before I get to the question, just mention who this is. So there was a German Rav in the 1800s named Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. And he's famous for his tshuvot. the Binyan Sion, but he also has a commentary on Gemara called the Aruch Lener. I'll just mention, just for general Jewish history knowledge, okay, he's already a start of the phenomena that German rabbis got a secular education, right? Our whole debate about secular education was not invented like in the 20th century. Already there was a split in the 1800s, and where Eastern European rabbis might not have gone to university, German rabbis did. So Rav Ettlinger was one of the first Orthodox rabbis to go to university. Okay, so he raises a great point. And I think once you ask, you need someone to raise the point, because once you ask the question, I think the answer is pretty straightforward. Let's go back to the offer. What was the offer? So let's read very carefully. Ani v'ata uben Yishai n'tayel b'gan Eden. Right, you and the son of Yishai. So isn't it clear there what the sequence is? What, who gets precedence? It's clear that he gets precedence, right? He's mentioned first. He doesn't say, God does not say myself, David, and you. He's myself, you, and David. So how come when he says, me, Barosh, who's going to be in charge? Who's going to have prominence? The answer is David. So Rav Yaakov Ettlinger asked this question in source two. But here, if you think logically, I'm sure some of you are thinking about it already. I know we have a very sharp group here. Okay, there's one obvious answer, which is maybe something changed in the middle. And what's the one thing that changed in the middle? The one thing that changed is that Yeravam said, me Barosh, which would mean, I think it's extremely clever. God, you know, I'm not going to read it inside. Those of you with the skills can do so. By the way, as I've been getting emails from people, I've been discovering what an interesting crowd we have. Okay, I'll just, I don't know if I should call them out now, but we have the former head of Jewish studies in Waterloo University. Is that correct? Head of Jewish studies in Waterloo? Okay, that's Paul Sackett. I don't see his name here, but I think he is here. Okay, so in any case, a lot of interesting people here. So says the...
Yes, I am.
Oh, there he is. Paul Sackett. Paul Sackett used to be head of Jewish studies at Waterloo. Okay, so...
not really. I was the founder of the program. I was in French studies.
Ah, okay. Sorry. Okay. But in any case, what does God appeal to? God appeals to a more idealistic kind of tshuva. Yerava, maybe you realized you really caused disunity in Am Yisrael. It was really problematic. Maybe you'll do tshuva in the most authentic way possible. And guess what? If you do tshuva in the most authentic way possible, you'll actually be ahead of David HaMelech. Tremendous. Ah, once Yeravam says, me Barosh, who's going to be in charge? We already see he's not capable of that. He hasn't really shifted gears, right? He's still in his old world, a world of honor and arrogance. At most, he'll do like a second grade tshuva. He'll do a tshuva, I don't know, for out of fear of punishment. That's the most he's capable of. He's not capable of more idealistic modes. If that's true, he's going to be behind David. So I think, A, it's what I like about it, A, is it's a very close reading. Rav Ettlinger picks up on the original offer being Ata Uben Yishai. And then, however, when he asks, suddenly David's in ahead. And he also notices that, again, yet another layer to the Gemara, right? This sad aspect of humanity that we're sometimes so wrapped up in our own ego that we actually destroy what we could really accomplish. So you already got that in the Gemara that, you know, Yeravam turns down the offer because he cannot stomach being behind David. But now you see it's even worse. By asking me Barosh, he ironically caused himself to lose that prominence. Okay, so that's one example where an achron, a recent authority from the 1800s, adds a nice layer of understanding to the Gemara. Okay, let's look at another one now. Okay, here we go. This is also really, really interesting Gemara. Okay, we're going to end up, just to understand who we're going to get to here. So Rabbi Yehuda from Ger, the Ger Rebbe, was known as the Sfas Emes, the Sfat Emet. And a lot of people now, you know, we have a renewed interest in Hasidut in our community these days. A lot of people really like the Sfat Emet on Chumash. I have to admit, it's never done it for me. I actually think the Sfat Emet's genius is on Gemara. Okay, he's really underutilized on Gemara. In fact, since both my parents are here, I can mention this. I was so into the Sfat Emet at some point in Gemara that I bought a copy for both of my brothers. Although I'm not sure either one has used it since, but that's okay. They have it. So one day they'll get there. Okay. So, you know, I guess, you know, my parents could complain. I didn't buy the one for them. But in any case, let us see what we have over here. So there's a very, very interesting Gemara in Shabbat where David HaMelech wants to know when he's going to die. Kind of a natural desire to know how many years you have left. And this is just very fascinating, you know, psychologically and theologically. Apparently, that's not good for a human being. There seems to be a thought that a person should not know how many years they have left. That's not a healthy thing. Better to not know, you don't know, right? Without getting into why right now. I think we could think of different reasons why. But then David is insistent. So God tells him what day of the week he'll die. But he still has no idea when it'll be. But David somehow knows he'll die on a Shabbat. Okay, so now imagine that. Like, I don't know how many years this goes on for, but imagine, I know for 7 years, every Shabbat, David HaMelech thinks about it as his potential day of death. But he doesn't know. It could be a Shabbat 40 years from now. Okay, so that I'm picking up in the middle of that Gemara. Okay, so says the Gemara, I'm reading the English again in source 3. Now, every Sabbath day, he would sit and study all day. So look what David does. Every Shabbos, David learns Torah for the totality of the Shabbat. It's a 24-hour Torah experience. On the day that his soul was to be at rest, the angel of death stood before him, but could not prevail against him, because learning did not cease from his mouth. So Chazal seemed to have an idea that the angel of death, the Malach HaMavet, can't take you when you're living Torah. But somehow, when you're learning Torah, you have a guarantee, you have a protection, like a force field from the angel of death. So now David HaMelech's learning all day, so the Malach HaMavet can't get him. So previous Shabbatot, that was not a problem. But here, he's supposed to die. This is the day of his death. So now let's see what happens. What shall I do to him, said he. Now the Malach HaMavet is apparently a resourceful fellow. Now there was a garden before his house. So the angel of death went, ascended, and sowed in the trees. Okay, so he's making a lot of noise in the trees. Okay, somehow shaking them up. He, David, went out to see. What's that noise? So David HaMelech goes outside. As he was ascending the ladder, it broke under him. There, Bukani became silent from his studies, and his soul had reposed. Now notice, it's really difficult. It's not even the noise of the trees doesn't make him stop learning. It's only when he starts to fall from the ladder that he stops learning, and then the Malach HaMavet is able to get him. Okay, great. Now let's ask a question where the answer might be obvious. Now that's an interesting question. Okay, someone's asking an interesting question, which is, wait, how literally should we take this? Does it mean like he didn't go to sleep? Does it mean he didn't eat shal shuras? That is a good question. I admit, I'm going to duck it for now. You know, it is a reasonable question for sure. Now, if I asked you, here's a good example. You could have a very simple answer, and yet I think an answer that's much deeper. If I ask you, why does David HaMelech learn Torah every minute of Shabbat? So I think there's a simple answer. Okay, I think most of us are probably thinking already. He knew this idea that when you're studying Torah, the angel of death cannot get you. Since he knew this idea, he was preventing it. He had a trick for immortality. If I just learn Torah every Shabbat, all Shabbat, I'm good to go. And indeed, that is Rashi's reading. And again, nothing wrong with Rashi. I'm just going to highlight for a second. Says Rashi, have a yatev garas. Why was he sitting and learning? Says Rashi, shelo yikrav malach hamavet elav, so that the angel of death should not be able to get him. Okay, so he knew this. And indeed, it's clear as the Gemara plays out that this is true, right? It's clear in the Gemara that the angel of death can't get him until he does a trick to get David to stop learning. Except for one thing. There's something to be careful about in the world of logic. The fact that A produces a certain result doesn't mean that result was the motivation for act A. It is true. It's clear in the Gemara that the Malach HaMavet cannot get David while he's studying. That is clear in the Gemara. But it's not clear that that's what's motivating David. So what else could be motivating David? So here I think the Sfat Emet says something really profound. Okay, again, this is the Rebbe of Ger, the Sfat Emet. And maybe I'll convince you all that we should read him on Gemara. Okay, here we go. Again, I'm highlighting. Says the Sfat Emet, Yesh Lomar Mishum Decha Shu Yom Acharon. Every Shabbos, David HaMelech goes in knowing the possibility that this is his last day. So I think this is a very, very profound idea. Imagine any of us in this shir who knew that we had, let's say, 12 hours to live. In some ways, I would say that would be the biggest test of what we truly value in life. What could be a bigger test than that? You know, this is your last moments. So what are you going to do? How are you going to spend that time? So I can easily imagine someone saying, I'm going to be with my spouse, right? I loved my spouse for 50 years. I will spend the last 12 hours with him or her. I could see someone saying that. I could see someone saying, you know, there's this relative I want to catch up with who haven't spent time with lately. I'll fill that in. I could see someone saying a lot of things, right? But let's say somebody who's a bit more hedonistic, right? They might say, you know, only one last chance to have a, you know, good burger, right? Better run out to the local fellowship restaurant, right? So you could imagine a lot of things. But I'd say either way, that urgency, right, of the last ones knowing these are the last hours would definitely really be a window into what you truly care passionately about. So says the Sfat HaMer, I think this is great. If we envision David as someone who loves studying Torah, so someone might say, so David HaMelech could easily say, wait, this might be my last day this Shabbat. I'm going to study Torah every minute, right? Because not as a force field, not as a trick to beat the Malach HaMavet. It is out of a sense of passion, at a sense of this is what I am truly passionate about. Again, so again, I see we see, once again we see how the achronim come in, right? Someone from the last 150 years, and add a layer of really beautiful depth to the Gemara. Okay, that is number two. We're going to see a third, I think, and we'll see what the timing is, and perhaps go to academia. Once I'm mentioning, you know, various illustrious people in the crowd. Okay, so we already mentioned Professor Sagan. You should also know that we have a fellow named Gershon Hefner who writes poems about Agadot. Okay, so we've got a lot of talent here in the crowd. We've got professors and poets. Okay, let us go to source six. And here is something very important to realize, because here there's a major contribution to the world of Agadah, but major and yet limited. Okay, let me explain what I mean. Okay, we're probably all familiar with Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, right? One of the most important rabbanim of the 20th century. And of course, the rabbi who was most associated with having a positive evaluation of the Zionist project, right? Certainly when the Zionism started, and it was really started by secularists. So, you know, it wasn't about, you know, Shabbos and Kashrut and things like that. So the majority of the Orthodox rabbinate was pretty negative. And Rav Kook saw a lot of positive. So he was a very, very important rabbinic figure. Most of his svarim have the word ayah in them, which is an acronym, of course, for Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen. Now, Rav Kook certainly believed in a broad curriculum. He did not say we just learn halacha and gemara all day. He wanted us to learn Tanakh and Jewish thought and Agadah. And he wrote a commentary on Agadah. So it sounds great, like I should count among the, you know, the pillars of Agadah with the Marsha and the Maral, except for one thing. Unfortunately, Rav Kook only wrote it on two Masechtot. We only have Einaya on Brachot and Shabbat. So he is incredibly helpful as Nagada commentary. At the same time, obviously, if I'm not learning Brachot or Shabbat, since it doesn't exist, it becomes much less helpful. I will just say one thing to make us all feel a little better. Thankfully, both Brachot and Shabbat have a lot of Agadah. So if you're going to only pick two tractates, that's a good way to go. Okay, and I don't know if he did it for that reason. He was just going in order, right? They also happen to be the first two Masechtot and Shas. But in any case, Rav Kook is incredibly helpful. Okay, I can't resist pointing out, I like to call his title of the book a triple play. Now, why is it a triple play? For the following reason. Okay, why would he call it A? I'm pointing at number seven now. Why would he call it Einaya? So the word Ein has agadic resonance because, of course, the famous collection of Agadot is called the Ein Yaakov. So if you hear the word Ein, you are thinking, oh, that might be an agadic book like the Ein Yaakov. Okay, then Ayah, of course, is his acronym. So you get Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen. Now, the third part, though, is very hard. I would never have gotten the third part if he didn't write this. Okay, there's actually a phrase in the middle of Sefer Eof, one of the more obscure svarim we've got. The words Ein Ayah actually appear. So it is a play on Ein Yaakov for Agada commentary. It is a play on his name, Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen. And it also, you know, alludes to a verse in Eof. So that's a pretty impressive title. Okay, so let's now go to see what Rav Kook contributes. Let me see what the chat point is. Okay. Okay, good. Okay, excellent. Okay, so now, just one thing, just in terms of Ben's point in the chat, Rav Kook, people don't realize he actually had a rabbinic career in Europe before he came to Israel. Okay, he came to Israel in the early 1900s. He actually was a rav in several small towns in Europe before that. So I know our vision of Rav Kook is we see him, you know, visiting kibbutzim in the land of Israel. Just realize that's not the totality of his rabbinic career. In fact, if I recall correctly, I'm pretty sure Einaya was written while he was still in Europe. I have to double check that. Pretty sure he was still in Europe when he wrote Einaya. Okay, let's look at sources 6 and 7. Now, one of the reasons we struggle with Agadah is I've been picking cases so far today, which is pretty easy what to make of it, right? The David HaMelech story and the Yeravam story are not that obscure. But we get Agadic ideas and stories where you wonder what is up. What were Chazal thinking? And then we really need help. So let's look at 6. I think you'll realize why a good commentary here might be crucial. Okay, here we go. They said in the school of Rabbi Yonai, what is meant by the verse, for the churning of milk brings forth curd, and the wringing of the nose brings forth blood, so the forcing of wrath brings forth strife. Okay, so this is a pasuk in Mishlei about how creating mitz, like a certain pressure, brings forth things. Right? All three phrases in the original are mitz x yotzi. The juice, the pressure on something causes Y to emerge. Okay, here we go. Says the Gemara, says Rav Yonai, with whom do you find the cream of the Torah? Because we talked about mitz chalav yotzi chema. So how do you get the butter of Torah? And let's assume that in the imagery, butter we imagine is something rather positive. Ah, with the him who spits out upon it the milk which he has sucked from the breasts of his mother. Now that seems rather odd. How do you get the really good part of Torah? How do you access the butter? Butter comes from milk. So if you're willing to, you know, vomit out, spit out your mother's milk, then you get to the butter of Torah. So of course, the $1 million question is like, why is this a positive image? Why is spitting out your mother's milk, right? Why is that something positive that enables access to the butter of Torah? Now, here again, we can certainly sit and speculate. I personally did not come up with anything great till I got a little help here. But now let us go to Rav Kook in Source 7. And Rav Kook says something I think really tremendous, which has real implications for educators. Sounds like I definitely know that, you know, quite a few of the 50 of us are educators. So I think this is quite relevant. Okay, let's see Rav Kook here. Now, one other rule when we're reading modern Hebrew, the hardest words are always the transliterated ones. So here we go. Rabim heim ha-pedagogim. Okay, so interesting. So Joyce did something interesting here. Joyce suggests that spitting out mother's milk has to do with your youthful learning. I think, Joyce, you're very close. Okay, Rav Kook is going to take your idea, I think, and just take it one step further. Very good. Okay, like maybe, ever guess where Joyce is at? Like maybe, it's obviously there's nothing negative about nursing from a mother. What's more beautiful than a baby nursing from a mother? But maybe that there's something, I don't mean this negative, but there's something childish about that. And adulthood means getting beyond that. So I think Joyce is onto something. Maybe that's what the Gemara means, that the butter is somehow a more mature approach that gets beyond the nursing baby. So with that, very good, Joyce. With that, let us see this Rav Kook. So again, of course, the third word is pedagogues, the teachers. Rabbi Mema pedagogim, there are many educators. Hamit Nasim Lavi Drachim, what is their educational goal? Lahakel et ol halimud, to lighten the yoke of learning. Meaning, what would many teachers say? Wouldn't it be better if we made the educational process easier? Right? Instead of students acquiring knowledge through arduous labor, what if you could find an easy way to do it? Okay, what would be an example? What if, I don't know, I tried making a good jingle, a good song for all kinds of pieces of information? Right. So, where did I hear someone do this? Oh, I just heard someone do a song of the entire periodic table. I admit I never in my school career had to memorize the periodic table, but someone had a song where they knew just curious. Did anybody know the entire periodic table? Okay. You want to raise their hand there? Okay. Doesn't sound like any of you learned that song either. Okay. But, in any case, we'd say that like we could get all this information, firmly in hand or in someone's head, if we just, you know, made a little entertaining, a little ditty for the information. Okay, says Rav Kook. I'm back to the Rav Kook piece now. V'choshvim, and what do they think? She'yavo bracha la'olam. This is going to bring blessing to the world. B'haknotam et idiot v'alimudim atariyim b'ofen klal. You could acquire all this knowledge in easy way. We were all thirsty for knowledge. Give us this easy way to do it. And you won't have to do too much toil. Says Rav Kook, the benefit is misleading. Right. Now, I think if I asked you, why doesn't this method work? I think you could all come up with various reasons. Okay. Rav Kook is saying it seems pretty tempting, right? Let's just make a good jingle. Let's make a good music video. Right. And we'll have it all down. It works sometimes. Probably a few of us got through trigonometry thanks to Sokotoa. Right. That's how we remembered what sine, cosine, and tangent was. Okay. So let's go for it. So let's see what Rav Kook's critique is. Rav Kook's critique, I think, is rather penetrating. Says Rav Kook, okay, let me highlight again. Says Rav Kook, here we go. Ki hayidiot, knowledge, lo timdadna, can't be measured, al pi kamutan, based on its quantity. Ki im al pi echutan, but by its quality, al pi omek hahavana, when it comes to the depth of understanding. So Rav Kook is going to have a dual critique of this educational philosophy. But the first one is as follows. If you think about it, all the things I mentioned are memorizing the list, right? I need to memorize sine, cosine, tangent. I need to memorize the periodic table. Some of you might have learned a song for the 24 books of Tanakh, right? But okay, if it's just like superficial list of information, then I admit this method does work. But what about depth of understanding? You can't teach depth of understanding in a song, right? You have to go through the process, right? You're debating, I don't know, what works better. I don't know, capitalism or socialism. So you can make up a song, here are the three advantages of capitalism, here are the two advantages of socialism. But the students won't really get it, right? It's not just like listing names. You have to really understand, right? Understanding means you have to analyze. There's a process. Right. It can't just be given over in such an easy fashion. So says Rav Kook, sure, the quantity of knowledge could be helped that way, but the quality of knowledge cannot be helped that way. Okay. So that's his first critique. Let's read his second critique. Biyoter limudei haTorah, even more so regarding learning, al pi godel haroshem shepolim al halomed. We're also concerned with the roshem, right? With the impression that is made on the learner. Meaning there is not just an issue here of getting information across. There's an issue of the growth of the student. And students only grow if they have to work it out. They don't grow if they're just singing songs, right? Some of education, now again, just to clarify, I don't think we should make education like artificially difficult. It doesn't mean like the harder, the better. Obviously, you don't want to crush your students. But the idea that students won't have to sweat at all, they'll never find something difficult, that's not doing them a favor, right? Some of life is learning how to overcome difficulty, okay? Learning how to withstand the problem, that it's not so easy. Yeah, I've made this joke before, although my wife has pointed out a corrective. Like one of the things I like to say is, when you have a bright kid or a bright student, one of the healthy things in life is that everybody hits a stage where they're not the brightest guy in the room anymore. Right. Maybe you're the brightest person in the room in elementary school. You get to high school. Okay. Maybe it works in high school, but now you get to college. Maybe when you get to yeshiva, right? But then you get to graduate school and work on your doctorate. But, it's just this healthy thing. Okay. You know what? I'm not the brightest person in the room anymore, but life will go on. So, but my wife has pointed out to me that logically there must be somebody that's not true for. So I guess she is right. There is that one person who is still the brightest person in the room, even in graduate school. But I think for most of us, we have that moment. Okay, and that's a healthy thing, not a bad thing, right? To learn, you have to struggle a little bit sometimes. So now Rav Kook is saying something very beautiful. What's his reading? Ah, I want to get to your point. Okay, very good. Okay, we'll get to the point in a second about all the aids to Talmud study we have and how to navigate that, because I don't want to be all negative. Okay, but again, what has Rav Kook read the Gemara? So notice we have a Gemara that seemed totally, you know, bizarre. You're spitting out your mother's milk, and Rav Kook has taken it and given us a very significant educational message. As Joy said, right, what is the imagery of a nursing baby? That's how a child gets milk. And there's no effort involved, right? You don't go shopping. You don't have to cook. There's no processing. Well, I guess there's effort for the mother, I suppose. But as far as the baby's concerned, right, the milk bar is open. He's good to go, or she's good to go. But if you want something a little bit deeper, you want butter, butter has to be produced. Right. Butter is not just, you don't line up at the butter bar. So at that point, all of a sudden, you want to mature. You want to get something a little bit more, right? You actually have to be willing to spit out your mother's milk. Namely, not that there was anything wrong with it, but you have to be able to move beyond that. And says Rav Kook, that's true about education too. You want to grow as a student. You want to grow as somebody who's learning, right? It can't all be this easy lineup. Oh, I just line up and I'm fed the Torah. That's not the way it works. You have to work on it. Both if you want, and notice Rav Kook's 2 points. Both if you want depth of understanding, right? Again, information can be given over in an easy way. Depth of understanding cannot. And secondly, says Rav Kook, if you want to affect the student, the student's affected. The student grows by overcoming difficulties. And I'll say one thing. I'm curious. I wish I had more time. I'd like to go around the room, actually, but I won't be able to do it here. Okay, interesting, Susanna. Okay, so just, I'm going to get to the 1 second. Ah, very good. Okay, Robert Sugarman, I totally agree with you. We'll get to you in 1 second. Okay, but I wanted to, 1 second, what was I just thinking? I got distracted by looking at the chat. Okay, so, you know, I'll leave aside what I was going to say. It'll come back to me. But in any case, let's make a point here to, oh, it is right with the same sign. Now I remember. Okay, I think it's very interesting. I'm curious if this is true of some of you, but maybe just okay it in the chat. Don't, you don't have to call it out here. I think very often there are high school students who resent a demanding teacher, and then after high school, they appreciate that demanding teacher. I've noticed it's a pretty common phenomena, especially like in languages. Like you're very upset about, you know, the teacher who made me, you know, conjugate Hebrew verbs. Okay, oh, it was so boring when I was in 11th grade. And then all of a sudden, you know, one day you actually go to Israel and you want to be able to say a sentence and say, wow, thank God Mrs. X was really demanding. So I imagine some of you, okay, let me know if it's true. I imagine it's true for some of you. So I think that really fits what Cook is saying. Like, obviously, like, it can be frustrating to have to work hard. Obviously, it can be difficult to not understand something. But at the same time, I think we appreciate where that's where real growth appears. Okay, so now one last thing. Let me look at the last two chat comments. Ah, sorry. Okay, sorry, we missed you last week. The level of commenting wasn't as strong. No, I'm just kidding. It was quite fine. But we did miss you, though. Okay, so what I wanted to say, though, is that I don't want to take this too far. Like, I don't want anyone in this year to feel, oh, I looked in an art scroll, and therefore, you know, Rav Kook thinks I'm a loser. Okay, that is not what's going on here. But I think we could all realize that there's a balance. There's a balance between having answers provided for you and bouncing, really trying to work things out. So again, obviously it depends so much on a person's individualized situation, meaning what kind of background do you have? How much time do you have to give to it? So I imagine that if you have somebody, you know, I'll just pick a random thing. You have a 68-year-old man who never went to yeshiva. So he probably should be using the art scroll. Like he has no chance of, and not because he did anything wrong. He has no chance of figuring out the Gemara on his own. Okay, but if you are a 20-year-old seminary student with a lot of yeshiva background, so I don't think you should just be reading for the art scroll, right? If you have like a 3-hour morning seder, maybe learn how to read Gemara in the original Aramaic. Maybe that would be the goal, as difficult as it may be, right? Again, you'll look up individual words when you're stuck, but it won't be your go-to move at that point to just read from the English. So I think, again, everyone could be different. Like you could have somebody who's, I think for a lot of us, maybe Chumash is something we could tackle in the original. But Gemara might be harder. So again, so maybe that will be your compromise, right? Or your way of realizing both goals. In Chumash, you'll read it in the original Hebrew. And then when you learn Gemara, you will indeed go to the Schottenstein or the Art School or the Steinsaltz, whatever the case may be. Okay, but I think however we divide it up, though, yes. Correct, Rabbi Jaffe, correct 100%. Okay, Rav Kook is certainly trying to find meaning in the Sagadah. So he's not giving us his complete educational philosophy. I mean, he's not attacking, I'll be anachronistic, he's not attacking using art school Gemara. But he is saying what this Gemara might be trying to get at. Okay, so we're going to go to academics in a minute. I just want to sum what we've done so far. And anyone who wants to make a comment in the chat or just, you know, briefly comment out loud here. So again, one of the things I've tried to show you is we shouldn't think that our tradition is bereft of good Agada commentary. There's good stuff out there. It might take a little bit of work to locate it. But also that in the last 100, 200 years, a lot of Talmudic commentaries have taken the Agada more seriously. And here we had Rav Ettlinger from Germany in the 1800s understanding what happened with Yeravam's request for prominence. We had the Ger Rebbe, right, the Sfat Emet, giving us a profound reading of why David HaMelech would learn all day every Shabbat. Again, not as a protective device, but as a way of measuring what he really cares about. as a way of not measuring, but it exhibits what he really cares about. And finally, we have Rav Kook telling us, making sense of a very difficult Gemara and giving us some good educational philosophy as well. And again, just to remind everybody, right, many Achronim wrote a commentary on all of Shas, Rav Kook's Agada commentary, specifically Brachot and Shabbat. So those two tractates are where to go. Okay, that finishes part one of this year. Let me just look at the last chat question. Okay, excellent, excellent. Okay, great. By the way, I think what was just said is really true, meaning Gemara is not so easy. So I could easily imagine somebody saying, you know, when I read the art scroll, that doesn't make it easy either. It doesn't take the work out of it, which I think is true, right? You're in a complex legal topic, I don't know, dealing with the finer points of ritual purity. It's not obvious that just because you open the Steinsaltz or the art scroll, you're just good to go. It's not like, you know, reading the back of a breakfast cereal, right? So again, I would just say that maybe the idea would be there should be some effort involved in the educational process. Okay, great. Let us move to academia. Okay, so I am going to do something that's a little bit different. Okay, I know I tend to be a bit of a critic of academics, but today I'm not going to be a critic. I am going to be a supporter. But before we get to my support, let me just mention some of tendencies in academia, which might make people less inclined to read them. But I'm going to give you three tremendous exceptions. Okay, here we go. Academic Jewish studies is very concerned with history and composition, just like academic Bible. So often there'll be a big focus on, oh, let's set this in its context. Okay, so if it's a Roman story, oh, let's learn more about the Roman Empire and we'll have a context. If it's a Babylonian story, oh, if we knew more about, you know, Babylon and Zoroastrianism, we'd understand it better. Okay, so there's truth to that. There's no denying it. Okay, but again, that could be like, move the focus a little bit, almost move the focus away from the literary quality of the text to the historical aspects. And composition also, I think you get with a lot of academics with the question of, oh, they'll trace the story. Like here's one version of the story in Bavli. There's another version of the story in Medrash Rabbah. Can we judge which one is the first version, which is the second version, etc.? So again, I'm not saying that any of that is worthless. But I do think sometimes I find it a distraction. Like in my mind, the most important aspect of a Talmudic story is what message is it trying to say? So I, by the way, just to be clear, I would say the same about Shakespeare, not just about Gemara. Like if someone says they're more interested in, you know, how much Plutarch Shakespeare used when writing Julius Caesar, that's a good topic for a doctorate. But I'm more interested in the messages of Caesar. Right. If was it legitimate to kill someone because you thought he was going to become a tyrant, but he's not a tyrant right now. Right. That seems to me a more important question than how much Plutarch Shakespeare used. OK, so that is why I'm sometimes hesitant about academia. But I think they're like everything else. They're academics who really do care deeply about the meaning, the ethical meaning, the religious meaning. And I'm going to mention three of them. Okay, the father of academic Agada study is a man named Yonah Frankel, who passed away. Okay, he was a professor in Israel. He wrote some beautiful books about Agada. And two contemporaries, who both of them I know are very, very fine people, is a fellow named Jeffrey Rubenstein, who teaches at NYU. He lives in Englewood. If anyone here in the group lives in Englewood, you might know him. Okay, and a fellow named Yonatan Feintuch, Tani Feintuch, who lives in Yerushalayim. Okay, and they both have, the three of them, Frankel, and who passed away, and Rubenstein and Feintuch have done a great job where they do use academic methodology, but they're very much involved in meaning also. So maybe we'll go in backwards order, actually. We'll do the less significant ones and get to the most significant one at the end. Okay, and we'll see how they might bring, you know, new approaches to the table where you might not find in traditional commentary. Okay, so let's go with the source 12. Now, source 12 is an Agadah about Herod. And it says that Herod killed almost all the sages, and then he felt badly about it. So he's talking to one surviving sage named Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, and he's trying to figure out what he could do to make up for it. So he asks Yehuda ben Bava, what should I do now? I killed all the sages. So let's see the answer here in source 12. Says Yehuda ben Bava, as you have blinded the eye of the world, for so the rabbis are called, as it is written, if it be done, I should give you a piece of background. Okay, the piece of background is, how did Herod become king? So Herod was once a slave, but then he married into the Hasmonean dynasty. Okay, so there's a whole question of, was Herod really worthy from a lineage perspective for the monarchy. So that should be in the background. Okay. Keep that in the background. Okay. So now let's go back here. As you are blind to the eye of the world, for so the rabbis are called, as it is written, if it be done unwittingly by the eyes of the congregation, go now and attend to the eye of the world, which is the temple. He's playing with different things that could be viewed as Einayim. You could view the sages as the Einayim. You could view the temple as the Einayim. So if you kill the sages, fix up some other, like you can't bring them back to life. That's not within your power. Fix up some other eye. As is written, I will profane my sanctuary, the pride of your power, the delight of your eyes. Now, many of you know history, right? That Herod indeed refurbished the second Beit HaMikdash and was much more beautiful afterward. So this is the Talmudic version of how that happened. So now Herod replied, I'm afraid of the government of Rome. Right? One of the tricky things of the last years of the Second Temple, of course, was the Romans were really the people in authority, even though there was a Jewish leader. Okay, he said, send an envoy and let him take a year on the way and stay in Rome a year and take a year coming back. In the meantime, you can pull down the temple and rebuild it. So where Yudimovit does the old bureaucratic trick, right? You know, send in the request and get it done while the request is being processed, right? It'll be like a three-year process. Right? We should all try this to deal with bureaucracies. Okay, I guess we don't always have control of the situation, I suppose. But it'll take a year to get there, a year of deliberation, a year to get back. By that time, you say, sorry, I did already. I didn't have an answer. Okay, he did so and received the following message from Rome. Okay, so what did Rome say? Now, I guess Rome was a little bit aware of this possible trick also. Because look what Rome says. If you have not yet pulled it down, do not do so. Right? No, we don't want you to. If you have pulled it down, do not rebuild it. If you have pulled it down and already rebuilt it, you are one of those bad servants who do first and ask permission afterwards. So I guess the Romans were on to the trick. But what can you do? Is it a done deal? Right, Herod had already taken down the old Beit HaMikdash and refurbished and put up the new one. So at that point, it's all over. Okay, so it's a cute Gemara, but speaking of reading things in the original, Tani Feintuch makes an excellent point, and you really need to read the original. So we're going to look at the original in 1 second. Okay, now what did it say in the Aramaic? Let's get the English, excuse me. Bad servants, what do? You act first and ask permission afterward. Okay, now look at the Aramaic original. Okay, this is really amazing. Avdei Bisha, okay, you are a bad servant. Batar de Avdin, let's be tricky here. Avad in Aramaic, Ayin Betal means to do. That's why in Uvda is a story. Okay, Batar de Avdin, after you've done it, Mitmalchin. Now this is even more confusing because Nimlach in Aramaic is to deliberate, to consult on a decision is Nimlach. So what does it mean literally? Batar de Avdin, Mitmalchin. After you did it, then you consult, right? The Romans are on. We know what tricks you do, Herod, right? You do it first and then you consult. Ah, but let's say we forget about our knowledge of Aramaic for a second and just look at the words. Can we catch a really clever play on words here? What would it mean, Batar da'avdin mitmalchin, if you just look at those words and read them more in Hebrew than Aramaic? Okay, actually, I'm going to wait for someone to get this because this is a great play on words. Batar da'avdin mitmalchin. If you go, yeah, go ahead.
Better to be a servant than a king.
Okay, excellent. Right. Don't forget Herod's whole thing, his lack of certainty was, wait, maybe he's not really appropriate fit for kingship. He's really just a servant boy. So couldn't you read it as, wait, what are the Romans really saying to him on the second level? After you're a slave, now you're a monarch. That's the way you think it works, Herod. But so that is really clever. Now, I wouldn't say, oh, very good. Alana, excellent. You see, Alana got that because she was once my wife's student. Excellent, Alana. Okay, so I would say, again, this is not like a critique, but I think traditional commentaries aren't thinking about plays on words so much. I'm not saying they never do. I can think of examples where traditional comedy does know to play on words. But I think for a lot of traditionalists, like play on words are like a little too, they're not serious enough for them, right? We deal with serious stuff now with these like artistic flourishes. But I think that's something we get here from Feintuch. And it's really, I think it's incredibly convincing, right? Even though the literal in the sense, literal meaning is, wait, you only consult with us after you've done it, right? The Romans are complaining. But it's hard when you read the original to not hear the old insecurity of Herod. Ah, Herod, you're a servant and you think you could be the king? That's not the way life works. So I think you could have, Feintuch's really added a layer here where that line now works on two levels. Okay, terrific. Let's now go to Jeff Rubenstein. Okay, we'll go up a little bit. Okay. Now, one other thing we talked about academics being inclined to study the history. Now, it's not just history, of course, it's language as well. Okay, and knowledge of Greek and Latin could be helpful, right? We know there are plenty of Greek and Latin words, and plenty of Greek words, I should say, in Gemara. Okay, so that could also be something that might help us work something out. Okay, so let's look at this Gemara. Okay, now this Gemara towards the end of Kiddushin, which has a series of stories about various sages who struggle or have some kind of dialogue with the Yetzer Hara, with the evil inclination. So one of them was a man named Plimo. So what does it say here? Plimo used to say every day, an arrow in Satan's eyes. One day, it was the eve of the Day of Atonement, certainly a good day, Erev Yom Kippur, good day to think about the Yetzer Hara. He disguised himself as a poor man. He is the Yetzer Hara, not Plimo, and went and called at his door. So bread was taken out to him. So, okay, so Plimo is going to try. Plimo somehow resents the fact that, the Yetzer Hara resents the fact that Plimo says every day an arrow in his eye. So he's going to challenge him. So he shows up as a pauper at his door. Okay, so they bring him bread. On such a day, he pleaded, when everyone is within, shall I be without? So Plimo is going to really challenge him. Wait, what kind of charity is that? Like, I'm eating out here in the cold. Could I sit on your warm couch and eat a little bit? Thereupon, he was taken in and bread was offered him. But Plimo points out, you still haven't gone all the way. On a day like this, he urged, when everyone sits at a table, shall I sit alone? Right, you're still creating a sense of distance from here. And this, I admit, is very hard. Very hard for any of us. Like, we're willing to give to the pauper, but are we really willing to, like, bring the pauper in? But the pauper says, yeah, I'm not at the table. I'm just an outsider. Ah, he was led and sat down at the table. Okay, so every time he challenges Plimo, Plimo responds. As he sat, his body was covered with suppurating sores, and he was behaving repulsively. So again, this often happens with poor people or the homeless, right? There's something, you know, I'm sorry to say, like, aesthetically repulsive about them, right? They're dirty. They're not clean. Okay. Their clothing is not so nice. Sit properly, he rebuked him. So Plimo gives him rebuke because he was acting. I guess it wasn't just his appearance here. It was also his behavior. Said he, give me a glass of liquor. And one was given him. He coughed and spat his phlegm into it. So again, so this disguised Yetzer Hara is acting in a more and more disorienting manner, in a more disgusting manner. They scolded him. So they give him tochacha twice, right? They give him rebuke again. Whereupon he swooned and died. Then they, the household, heard people crying out, Plimo has killed a man, Plimo has killed a man. You know, people love, the community loves a bit of good gossip. So this fellow went to Plimo's house and he died. And now everyone's talking about, oh my God, Plimo, the way he treated this guy, the guy died. Okay? Now, Plimo is very embarrassed. Fleeing, he hid in a privy. He runs to the bathroom, like, Plimo doesn't know what to do, make himself. He, Satan, followed him. And he, Plimo, fell before him. Seeing how he was suffering, he disclosed his identity. So Satan reveals himself. It wasn't really a poor person, it was me. And said to him, why have you always spoken thus? So apparently, this really requires more thought, which I'm not going to give it today, just in the interest of time. But apparently, there's some objection to the way he would say every day, an arrow in the eye of Satan. He shouldn't say that. And Satan apparently correctly says, you shouldn't have said that. Then how am I to speak? So Plimo says, what should I say? Like, obviously, I want to beat out the Yetzer Hara. You should say the merciful rebuke Satan. So it's quite an interesting idea. I'm not sure if it's like an overconfidence Plimo had or an excessive negativity, but somehow don't say an arrow in the eye of Satan. Don't say that. Say, God should help me deal with Satan. That would be a more appropriate thing to say. Fine. So let's think for 1 second, though. And here we're going to use Jeff Rubenstein's knowledge of Greek, although even if you just know English, it's quite helpful. Okay, so does the word plimo, or the, let's maybe just do the lettering. Does PLM remind you of a perhaps relevant English word or Greek word if you happen to know Greek? Okay, what do you hear in that, in PLM?
Okay.
Okay, anyone else? Okay, so Rubenstein claims, now again, I'm not enough of a linguist to work this out. Wait, let me see if somebody wrote. Ah, oh my God. Alana Lubin. Okay, we have a lot of star students here. I have to recruit you to my shiur. You should all come to my daily shiur. It'll be more fun. Okay, so Rubenstein thinks it's related to the word polemic. Okay, and if it's related to the word polemic, what may go on? That maybe that's who Plimo is taking too polemical a stand vis-a-vis the Satan. That the Satan is part of the created order. It is needed. Actually, the other point that the Yetzer is necessary. And maybe Plimo shouldn't think about, you know, every day I'm just going to put an arrow in that scene. Maybe that's problematic. Maybe it's too contentious, right? So if he's right, I don't know if he's right, but that would work out great, right? His name, right? Often names are symbolic, right? You know, when you read Megillat Rut and two characters are called Machlon and Chilion, and all they do is die, it's hard not to see symbolism there, right? Machlon and Chilion basically means like disease and destruction. Well, if two characters are named disease and destruction, they die in the fourth pasuk, so probably that's on purpose. So if plimo really should make us think of the Greek word polemic, so again, you might say, oh, we get another layer of meaning here, right? That plimo is too polemical in his relationship with the satan. Okay, terrific. Okay, someone said it reminds them of Bria. Okay, maybe at 6 o'clock, you'll tell me why it reminds you of Bria. Okay, let's do one last one and wrap it up here. Okay, this will be the deepest one. Okay, so we did what Tani Feintuch has to offer. We did a little Jeff Rubenstein. Now we go to Yonah Frankel. Now, one other point I want to make here is that sometimes you have a story within a story. And I like when that happens very much because there's like two things to analyze. There's the larger story, which includes the inner story, and you could just isolate the inner story. So I'll just give you the larger framework here and we'll do the inner story. The larger framework here says, oh, let's read actually. Our rabbis taught the poor, the rich, and the sensual come before the heavenly court. So now the larger story is how none of these are going to have a good excuse at the end, right? They're all going to be asked, why didn't you study the Torah? And the poor person will say his excuse, and the rich person with his excuse, and the sensual person with his excuse, and God will come up with a counterexample, or the heavenly court, sorry. The heavenly court will come up with a counterexample to the excuse. But then, so you could discuss the story at a meta level, all three of those characters together in the heavenly court, but you could also analyze each specific counterexample, because each counterexample is a story. So we're going to do the narrow version over now. Now, we're only going to analyze the narrow counterexample story of the poor. Okay, so let's read a little more. This is very famous. You all know it, so we'll go through it pretty quickly. I shouldn't say you all know it. Majority of you know it, for sure. They say to the poor, why have you not occupied yourself with the Torah? If he says, I was poor and worried about my sustenance, which is, to me sounds like a pretty good excuse, right? It's very debilitating to be poor, okay, both the long hours of work and emotional turmoil. Okay, they would say to him, were you poorer than Hillel? So Hillel, the famous Tana, the famous Talmudic sage, is the counterexample. Oh, you could be poor and still study Torah. Okay, so again, there's always a counterexample. Now we get to the Hillel story. It was reported by Hillel the Elder that every day he used to work and earn one trepik, a certain ancient coin, half of which he would give to the guard of the house of learning, meaning there was a tuition, apparently. You had to pay to get into the shir, to get into the Beit Midrash. The other half being spent for his food and for that of his family. Okay, one day, now again, thank God, I think I shouldn't speak for everybody else, but I've never lived this way. Like, it's hard to imagine living such food to mouth. Right? Oh, if I don't make money today, I can't feed my family dinner. Okay, but some people do live like that. One day he found nothing to earn, and the guard at the house of learning would not permit him to enter. Okay, so he's a day laborer. He doesn't get a job one day. He does not have the money to get into the Beit Midrash. Now, Hillel was very desperate to learn. He climbed up and sat upon the window or the skylight to hear the words of the living God from the mouth of Shemayna Avtayon. Okay, so his two teachers from Avtayon are giving shir, and he's out there on the window or the skylight listening in. Okay, they say that day was the eve of Sabbath and the winter solstice, and snow fell down upon him from heaven. By the way, you see that, not that you need a Talmudic proof, but you see that it sometimes snows in Yerushalayim. Not too often, but it does snow occasionally in the land of Israel. Okay, when the dawn rose, Shemaya said to Avtalion, Brother Avtalion, on every day this house is light, and today it is dark. It is perhaps a cloudy day. Now, of course, it's dark because the window or the skylight is being covered by a prone human figure, right? Hillel is covered with snow, covering up some of the light. Okay, they looked up and saw the figure of a man in the window. They went up and found him covered by 3 cubits of snow. They removed him, bathed, anointed him, and placed him opposite the fire. So apparently he was still alive. So they clean him off and they warm him up. And they said, this man deserves that the Sabbath be profaned in his bath. Now, just to clarify, obviously you don't have to be of Hillel's stature where Michal Shabbos to save anybody. But I guess the point is he really deserved it. And it's not 100% obvious where the Chilul Shabbat is here. Also, not clear which act they did is a clear violation, but let's leave that be for now. Okay. They were Michal Shabbos, and they saved his life. Okay, so this is clearly a story of Hillel's dedication. So if I just had this story and I'm teaching, everybody's okay, the Gemara wants to point out how one can be so dedicated to Talmud Torah and overcome obstacles. But Frankel, Yonah Frankel, does something very clever. He claims that it shows something else, which is as follows. Education has the following duality. On the one hand, there's a pragmatic part. There's no denying it, right? If my yeshiva didn't charge tuition, we couldn't stay open, right? So what do you want? Like, someone has to pay teacher's salary, someone has to pay for lunch. At the same time, you would never want a school to become a business, right? That it's not about making profit. And there's got to be some leeway for those who are not affluent. So there's this constant tension in the world of education. Like, on the one hand, you would like to be idealistic. On the other hand, you do have to charge. But Frankel says, and I think he has a good argument, this poor guy Hillel pays every day. You'd think you could find a way, if there's one day he can't come up with the tuition money, the entrance fee, find a way to let him in. Right, you're not saying give him a lifetime exemption from paying. Not at all. He pays every other day. Right, but how could it be? Like, there isn't that amount of flexibility to let him in this one day. So Frankel takes it as a critique. It's both a praise of Hillel and a critique of this Beit Midrash. But now you might say, Frankel, that's very nice. Do you have any evidence? So he claims that there's one line here that should be read symbolically, not literally, or it could be read on two levels also. Okay, which again shows, I think sometimes the academics are onto something when they realize that you could read something on two levels. Can anyone tell me a line in the story that takes on new symbolic meaning now? Okay, that is not just its literal meaning in the storyline, but now has another meaning. Okay, if we agree with the Yonah Frankel's reading of this Gemara. I see somebody got it. Let's go to the chat. And okay, Alana Lubin, you know, if you're my shir, I would have to like ask you to stop answering the questions correctly. Okay, we'll have to give somebody else a chance. But totally right. Isn't that powerful? What do they say? What does Shmai and Avtalion say to each other? They say every day, right? Every day. Where's the line? One second. Ah, every day this house is light and today it is dark. Now, again, you could read that on a purely factual level and say what it means is that, okay, usually light comes through the window, but it doesn't anymore, right? Because there's a human being there. That's what happens. Ah, you could say it much more sharply now. You could say, Beit Midrash is a place where Torah is taught, where wisdom is spread. That is a place of great illumination. But if we chose to keep out a poor fellow on the one day he couldn't pay, it's a dark day in the Beit Midrash. So I think that would work out very beautifully. So now, just to sum up the second part this year, okay, and hopefully I've convinced you all not only that a Gaddik study is worth doing, but that we have good resources to go to. Okay, so we discussed in the first half how Achronim contribute, and now we're seeing how academics contribute. Again, I would say, like everything else, you have to pick the right people. There are academic voices where everything is very technical. We don't really get at the deeper meaning, but the three people that we experienced today, I think we're all not like that, where we had, Tani Feintuch picking up on the play on words, right? That, I used to be either you did it and then consulted, Avad Nimlach in Aramaic, or in Hebrew, the slave who became a king, Herod. Then we had Jeff Rubenstein's knowledge of Greek helping out, that he relates Plimo to polemic, that Plimo is polemicizing against the Satan, perhaps in an inappropriate way. And now we have Frankel doing a very close reading of the story, where he finds a theme that wasn't clearly there, right? The theme that's clearly there is Hillel's dedication. But Frankel says, I think there's another theme there of the methodology of the Beit Midrash there. Okay, I've been to Israel too long. I had this Hebrew and I couldn't think of anything from policy. Thank you. I was trying the English word for Mediniut. Okay, oh my God, I got to move back to America. Okay, Mediniut policy. Okay, so they have problem policy. Like, okay, you could charge, but how could it be? You can't let the poor guy in one day. And that is the imagery of the darkness of the Beit Midrash. Okay, would anybody like to comment on anything from the four shiurim? That's who got in the chat here. Okay, Paul, we'll miss you. Keep up Jewish studies in Waterloo, Paul.
Is it possible also to say that the last line of that Gemara, Ra'ui ze l'chalel alav at the Shabbat, that was Hillel was more makil, and that it was a teaching that not to be so machmir either in terms of the entrance fee to the Beit Midrash, but also to learn how to be Mekil also at the appropriate time, which was the essence of Hillel.
That's very clever. Just, I'm sorry, I couldn't identify the voice. Who was it?
Chaim.
Ah, okay. Chaim, very good. I didn't think of that. Like maybe lurking in the background here is also Hillel as, you know, the lenient voice, tells the understanding voice. And maybe there's almost a contrast in Hillel and the Beit Midrash, that he's coming from a Beit Midrash that is tougher, okay, that doesn't give in. And Hillel appreciates that Hillel represents the antithesis of such a Beit Midrash. Chaim, very good. I did not think of that. It's very nice. You could throw in the last line. I think your idea works even without the last line, right? That it's obviously a very tough Beit Midrash, tough policies. And Hillel understands the need sometimes to bend policies. Okay, very good.
Is it also possible that Hallel is a play on the word Hillel?
Interesting. I have to think about it. Let me think about it a little bit. Okay, it's true. It's funny because my gut reaction is to not be so supportive, but there are Gemaras where they play with that. I think there's one Brachot about Hillel and Hillel, I think like in Brachot Lamed Hey. So maybe it wasn't so far into Chazal to play with Chen Hathaway. All right, Chaim Kranzler, very good. Another Agadic star here. Okay, anybody else with a comment on anything we did today or even something earlier?
I'm going to tell you about the Bruria comment that I
thought. Oh, yeah, please. What do you mean by that?
Didn't she once correct somebody about how they should address women, that they use too many words? So she redirected, you know, which way, whatever.
Yes, yes.
So that's what it reminded me about the Satan, who said, you shouldn't say an I in my thing. You should say that God should.
Okay.
It was redirecting how the idea should be said.
Okay, very interesting. I like what you're doing. I said one question. It's not exactly that, right? Because in the Bruria scenario, it's about the length of the speech, right? And in Plimo, I thought it's more about the content, less about the length. But I get, you're right, though. You could make a Talmud category.
But it's also the interaction with the woman to reduce it in this way. And it's to reduce the hatred of Satan.
Okay.
In a certain way.
Okay. Very good.
So I really thought that Kol HaResha'im Kerega Tovedu, and yes. Bruria changed it to Kol HaResha.
Okay, so there's actually two, you're combining two different Bruria stories.
Maybe
next time. Okay, next time I'll do a
series. Same idea, don't insult people, insult the idea.
Okay, excellent. Okay, there is a Gemara where Bruria reminds Rabbi Meir that we should be against sin, but not so naked about sinners. Okay, that's correct, but that's separate from the Gemara about the length of the conversation. Okay, I see Rachel's announcing about Rabbi Nadi Helfgott is giving Parsha tomorrow. He is an excellent teacher. I feel like I missed a comment above that. One second. Okay. By the way, somebody asked about the fee being suspended. That's lurking in the back of my mind, but it's not explicit in the Gemara. So I'm not sure that's obvious. It could be some commentary suggest that, but I'm not aware of where that would be so clear that Shmai enough times Beit Midrash stop charging. Okay. I'd have to check that out. If anyone has a source for that, I'd be happy to hear it. But I do not think it's so clear from the Gemara. Okay.
Can you tie in Shmaya Naftayon to Hillel's later career about Erev Pesach, when he tried to use logic and they wouldn't accept it? And when he said, I heard it from Shmaya Naftayon. So here he dies and there his connection to them saves his halakha.
Okay. So it's true. If we want to do like a larger study of Hillel, one would also bring in other Gemarot, because I guess in this Gemara, you might feel like Shmaya Naftayon don't come out so well. Although I don't know if they set the policy. But there is a Gemara in Pesachim where Hillel relies on Shmaya Naftayon to teach a long-lost halach about the Karban Pesach. Okay, but that, I think it's 6:05. I think I'm going to have to call it a day here. Okay, I just want to thank everybody for participating. I really enjoyed it, and I hope I'll be able to teach in this context again.
Thank you. Thank you.
I don't know. Just Alon, if you're still here, my wife just wants to say hello. Don't know if you're still here.
Hi, everybody.
Hello, everybody. Hello.
Oh, there she is. She's right there.
Hi.
Hello. How are you?
Good, thank God. How are you?
It's been a long time.
Very long time.
I actually was just cleaning out a drawer and found my Midrash Elidabam sweatshirt.
My daughter wears mine now.
The green one, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
All right, yeah. Where are you living?
Chicago.
Chicago, wow.
Yes, yes.
What brought you out to Chicago?
There's a Chabad community out here.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I homeschool my kids.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Wow, yeah. Okay. You teach them all miktzot, how do you say miktzot?
Subjects.
All subjects?
Yeah.
Are you teaching them Gemara?
As much as I can.
Okay, good.
Yes.
All right. I think I'm going to close up here, Alana, but you should just know she got all the answers right today.
I was overhearing it. She got all the answers right, so.
In regards from the Landos.
Great to see you.
Who's it? Oh,
Julia Mariano.
You're Rivka's mother, right?
Hi. Hi.
Okay.
I last saw you at a shir in Teaneck many years ago.
Many years ago, but we're here now. We made Aliyah a year ago.
Oh, wonderful.
Wonderful. Mazal tov.
Very nice.
Thank you.
In Yerushalayim?
Good to see you. We're in Ramat Beit Shemesh.
Very nice.
All right. I'm sorry. I'm going to close up here. You know, nice to shoes there, buddy.